Safety Policy and Oversight Committee. Today is Thursday, January 22nd. We're going to start with a presentation from NCSO on the Adam Walsh Act. Ms. Hammond, please begin.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Sarah Hammond, and I do work in the Denver office for the National Conference of State Legislatures in the Criminal Justice Programmers Council, and I just want to start off to say I'm very pleased to be here today. Thank you to Senator Mula and Representative Hilsum for having me here. It's my first time in Minnesota, so I also want to thank you for the nice letter. I've heard this is a better week than last week here, so anyway, I just regret that I can't stay as long as I'd like, but I'll be back. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit today about the Adam Walsh Act and what it means to the state. First of all, just a brief overview of what the requirements are in the Act. The Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act was signed into law in July of 2006. And the provisions of the Adam Walsh Act, which seem to be giving states heartburn, are Title I, which is the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, SORNA. And generally, the law requires state compliance with federal registration and notification standards. The SORNA is aimed to, in a sense, expand already existing state registration databases and connect them up with one national system. The SMART office, established under the Act, which stands for Sex Offender Monitoring, Apprehending, Registering, and Tracking, oversees the Act and will ultimately determine state compliance. States have until July of this year to comply or face losing 10% of federal funding of the Byrne JAG Law Enforcement Fund, which I will discuss in further detail later, since that's quite an important piece. Okay. Let's talk sort of about what sort of requires of states if states in fact choose to comply with this act. A fairly controversial and kind of the arguments that we've heard is that there's a very extensive and comprehensive tiering classification system, a federal scheme that requires states to match in a sense and sort of mirror the federal act by taking the registrable offense, looking at the offender's criminal history, and then based on those two, placing them into one of three tiers. These three tiers will then determine a lot of the other act requirements, duration, verification, it's the timing of everything. So this tier system is kind of the starting point. And as you can see on the slide here, Tier 1 is basically your catch-all category for offenses that don't fall under Tier 2 or 3. They are offenses such as possession of child pornography or perhaps failure to register. And it just escalates upwards as far as the severity of the offense. Tier 2, individuals convicted of most sexual abuse felonies or exploitation offenses involving minors. And then Tier 3, individuals convicted of sexual assault involving acts regardless of the age of the victim, sexual contact offenses against victims under 13, and kidnapping of minors, also conspiracies or attempts to commit any of the aforementioned acts. So as I mentioned, states have had concerns with this complexity, and important to note is they really need to look at their criminal code definitions to ensure that they mirror the federal requirements and definitions. SMART office that determines compliance has tried to clarify in statements by saying that they don't need to mirror it exactly, and a classification system just needs to have the spirit of the federal three-tier system. And as we go along here, you'll see that a problem throughout with all the different requirements is that since the SMART office has yet to grant substantial compliance to any state packages or laws that they may have submitted, there's no example out there for other states to look at what a tiering system might look like other than the federal act, which has this quite complex system. SORNA also requires when offenders must register. This is a new to many states. and they were requiring them to actually register when they're still in prison, requiring an official to inform the offender of his new duties under SORNA, and that he read and sign and say that he understands these duties, and then the official must ensure the registration takes place. If there's a sentence in court where there's no imprisonment required, the offender has just 3 business days to register all the information that is necessary. And the Act further requires that a penalty must be imposed for imprisonment of more than 1 year for failure to do this within 3 business days or when you are in prison. So again, this has some state's concerns with law enforcement spending a lot of time tracking down people who are not necessarily registering and not spending time maybe on other things that are important as well. So what is some of this registration information that needs to be collected? Again, most all states have, you know, required sex offenders to register, and many have databases. I've highlighted here in white sort of the common things that many states already require and are on state sex offender registries. And as you'll see in the sort of tan font, those are some that are newer to states that they're going to have to now, in addition to the original, require full registration. So the offender needs to provide now a social security number, phone numbers, addresses of not only his residence but of his employment, of school, passport, immigration documents. And then the jurisdiction must in turn provide text of the law violated, criminal history, the identity of the victim, which has concerns, fingerprints, DNA, and current copy of the driver's license. And again, states, you know, one of the concerns too is all state registration laws and systems are very different, and so this is not to say some states don't do some or of these, but in general, this is what we've seen as far as concerns with additional information. And it's additional work for the states to make sure all this is in order and submitted by the offender and the jurisdiction. So as I mentioned, state sex offender registries must be made public and searchable to everybody, and these are the following which need to be on the public database. And again, these will be linked to the one national sex offender public registry. So the idea behind SORNA is that anybody in any state can, with one type, one query, get any of this information about any offender in any state. So public database, name and alias, address of residence, the employment address, again, has been controversial, certainly with the employers, but they don't necessarily want that on the public website. Physical description and current photograph, and the text of the registered offense and past sex convictions. What cannot be on the public website is the victim's identity, social security number, for obvious reasons, arrest, not resulting in convictions, but convictions, past convictions may be on there, as we said, and passport and immigration document number. Okay, so back to the tiering system that I mentioned in the beginning. Again, as I said, the tier system affects other parts of other requirements of SORNA, and first being the duration of registration, how long sex offenders must be required to stay on these registries, the state and the national one. Tier 1 is 15 years, Tier 2, 25, and Tier 3 have to register their entire life. A new provision as well, some states had, not all states, but is the requirement of an in-person verification by the sex offender with local law enforcement. And this is to check in and make sure all of this information that I just mentioned is current and up to date. And fairly often, Tier 1 just once a year, Tier 2 every 6 months, but with your Tier 3 individuals, it's every 3 months. And again, if this in-person verification isn't happened, additional penalties are charged, and it's more of law enforcement's time to get them to come in and verify. So it seems quite a bit of work. Okay, moving on to one of the most controversial provisions in SORNA has been its treatment of juveniles. Child advocates and juvenile justice groups across the country have voiced their concerns, as well as, you know, states and juveniles in the system and parents, and we've heard a lot of concerns about this. And actually, this was, according to the SMART office, in the past year, there was, you know, an open period before they produced their final guidelines, where there was a public period for commentary, and they received, it was just overwhelmingly every negative or comment, not all negative, but everything was, please change the juvenile provisions, which they didn't really. So anyway, let me explain briefly what is entailed here. Juveniles prosecuted as adults in the adult system have to register, but the provision requirement that has concern is that they also, juvenile offenders also must be registered that are adjudicated in the juvenile justice system. And this applies to 14-year-olds who are 14 at the time of offense and are adjudicated delinquent for an offense comparable to or more serious than aggravated sexual abuse. And this is defined in federal law, I'll get to in a minute, or an intent or conspiracy to do so. One caveat about juveniles, which again has not comforted people, but they do have the option to petition for removal from the registry after 25 years. This is if they have a clean record and if they have completed a treatment program administered by the jurisdiction or the Attorney General, and they have not had their parole revoked. So that is one provision of SORNA as well. So just to follow up briefly on what aggravated sexual abuse means. It means a sexual act with another by force or the threat of serious violence, a sexual act with another by rendering unconscious or drugging the victim, or any sexual act with a child under the age of 12. And I think I already highlighted on some of this, but some of the concerns I just thought I'd bullet out are, again, that treating juveniles and adults the same way not necessarily is something that advocates argue, that brain research that's come out recently, studies that show that kids are more amenable to treatment than adults, doesn't mean that juvenile sex offenders should be treated exactly like adult sex offenders, and that it can have a harsh consequence on the rest of their life, especially some of these tier 2 and 3 juveniles who may be on there for quite some time and that they're affecting their employment or education opportunities. So again, these are some of the arguments we've heard. Okay, another provision is SORNA requirements to tribal jurisdictions. And before this law was before SORNA was passed, national federal sex offender registry laws with Jacob Wetterling and Megan's Law applied to the states and the territories in D.C., but tribal jurisdictions were left out of it. SORNA included tribal jurisdictions to the same requirements as the states. So if you are a federally recognized tribe, you are required to comply. There was a provision, which I didn't really get into here, it doesn't apply to Minnesota since you're a PL 280 state, but tribes actually had the option to opt out and have be sovereign put in their own provisions themselves, in a sense, and not have the state do it for them. But the PL 280 states, which is a law that transferred criminal jurisdiction from tribes to state governments years ago, six states, they tribes don't have this option, and so the states are responsible for the implementation, and the tribes must provide access and cooperate with the states. And this has received a fair amount of attention as well in the PL 280 states and the other as well. So, as part of SORNA, we have the Sex Offender Management Assistance Grant Program. And this was actually established to help the states offset the high cost of implementation. But ironically, no money was ever appropriated to the fund. So I believe the history was that they were going to provide, in the act, it states to be a 10% bonus for states who were found in compliance by July 27, 2007, a year and a half ago, but no money was ever in there, so any compliance advocates that even had a chance of being found in compliance would not have any money to award that. So this has been a complaint of states as well. Retroactivity is a part of SORNA. Another piece that's received a fair amount of attention because SORNA applies not only to sex offenders who are currently in the system, but those whose convictions predate the enactment. So that would be any sex offense that was committed before July 27, 2006, going back, doesn't even matter how many years. So people were a little bit up in arms about this, but when the SMART office came out with its final guidelines this summer, they clarified that states didn't have to go out and find these individuals roaming the streets kind of thing for crimes that they may have already satisfied in prison and get them to register. But they did say that if they're currently registering with the system, if they're under any supervision or incarceration, or if they re-enter the criminal justice system for any offense, you know, auto theft, something else, then the state would be required to get them registered and have all these new requirements placed on them. So that was how SMART rationalized that. So, and there's been a little bit of case law as far as retroactivity is concerned with constitutional issues, but so far retroactivity has been upheld. There was a challenge in Ohio and Maine, and actually the Supreme Court, even pre-SORNA, upheld it years ago. As far as we know, retroactivity will continue to be a part of this act, pending some other case to be handed down. So what exactly does substantial compliance mean? And SMART has said that SORNA is not a floor, SORNA is a floor and not a ceiling, and states are happy and free to go stricter and stronger. However, that hasn't really been a concern because many states feel that they are strict and strong enough. So basically it means that the baseline requirements are incorporated. And again, the complaint has been, since there have been no compliance submissions accepted, there's no sample for states to look at to see what substantial compliance means. But this is the advice that SMART gives when asked. So, and there is a provision in SORNA which provides for an extension request. So states can receive two separate one-year each requests from the SMART office. And per SMART, requests could include, their efforts and why they were unable to comply and, you know, what's exactly needed. And these are supposed to be in the SMART office by April of this year. So states can, in a sense, do this twice and get two more years, but they'll have to be approved. Actually, SMART has said recently that they won't release which states they have given extension requests to, but they have granted a few, according to them. So that's better than the compliance packages because they have not accepted any of those yet. So, and here is just a quick checklist, whether, you know, if the state chooses to comply along with the law, they would like comparative charts, the registry website documentation, explanations, any other items that might help SMART make the decision. So, and again, I don't mean to go too fast on any of these. I don't like to just read the point. I'd be happy to have this on our website or send anyone copies if they'd like the details of any of the bulleted points here. Okay, so sort of turning the corner here, I'd like to now talk about, since we've sort of covered what's required of states, kind of what we've been doing at NCSL is trying to figure out, since SORNA's enactment, so post-SORNA, what are states doing? Are they, you know, complying? Are they trying to comply? Not that we can determine compliance, but we can look at laws passed that are related to SORNA and try to determine sort of what's happening there. As I've mentioned, you know, state laws vary considerably from state to state as far as their registration and notification provisions. And there were many, many provisions already in law pre-SORNA, in fact. So what I'm going through is just post-SORNA. But what we've seen is about 30 states enacting new laws in 2007 and 2008. And some are more comprehensive than others, which I'll mention. And most of these do appear to respond to different provisions of SORNA, but we can't necessarily say that, and it may just be addressing their own policy interests. Like I said, states were there was never a time really before SORNA was enacted that we ever saw a pause in sex offender legislation. So it was not necessarily something that the federal government had to mandate since states weren't doing it. I've been tracking sex offender laws for years before SORNA, and there was always consistent increase every year in these kinds of laws, regardless of SORNA. So, comprehensive laws that we've seen, about six, and interestingly enough, these were all passed in 2007, not many in 2008 as far as one law that kind of, in a sense, almost mirrors the SORNA requirements. Delaware, Florida, Louisiana, Mississippi, Nevada, and Ohio. Again, all in 2007. And as far as we know, they've submitted some compliance packages, and Louisiana was found not to be in compliance. And that's the only information that we have through SMART. So, some other aspects of SORNA and its requirements. Probably the most significant that we've seen is this expansion of registration information required, which again we saw even before SORNA was a trend. But especially as you can see the numbers here on the slide, 21 states in the past 2 years have added online identifiers. And those are blog rooms, internet addresses, any chat room, they need to submit their username, all that kind of stuff. And that seems to be something, again, where we're asking, are they doing this because of SORNA, or are they doing this because it's good policy for the state with the increased concern with children online and all that growing? So it's interesting. 21 states we've seen all have the same law passed with these online identifiers. We've seen 8 states increase the registration information to include driver's license and description of your car. DNA, requiring a DNA specimen as part of that registration, we've seen in 8 states. And 4 states, Delaware, Ohio, Wyoming, and South Dakota, have implemented the penalties required of SORNA for failure to register. The tiering system, again, we've seen just about 5 states, Arkansas, Montana, Nevada, and Ohio in 2007, attempting to implement a tier system, and most recently New Hampshire just this past fall created a 3-tier system, which is very, very similar to SORNA. I spent a little time studying it and talking to some people in New Hampshire, and I think they were trying to mirror that. But again, that was one part they did. There's not a whole compliance package yet, so we see states kind of piecemealing parts of it, and it's interesting to see where that may go. 9 states listed there have required the in-person registration and updates from SORNA. And back to the juvenile requirements, we see 4 states have addressed the new juvenile requirements and laws. Nevada's provision was actually declared unconstitutional last year. The judge found that there was no rational reason for the age cap of 14, claiming, you know, someone who was 13 on his birthday was the next day, why would he be excluded from this registration? So that was found unconstitutional. I believe it's still pending. And then in Illinois in 2007, if you remember, I mentioned juveniles have this option to petition for removal after 25 years. I mean, and not up, you know, 25 years is the earliest. According to SORNA, they can do this. Well, in 2007, Illinois passed a sex offender law, which addressed some provisions of SORNA, and they included this. They're going to let juveniles petition for 5 years. And the governor actually vetoed it, and then both chambers came in and overrode this. So it was kind of this drama going on in 2007. And according to SMART, then obviously the 5 years wouldn't satisfy the 25-year requirement. They weren't going to budge on that, but this law is still in place, I believe. So I'm not sure what that says about Illinois, but that's some of their activities with SORNA. Other aspects of SORNA, duration of registration, just 3 states have addressed this and mirrored the SORNA law. The time frame, the three states now require that 3 business day rule. And public access to offender information, we see 7 states expanding their databases to this. We also see, which is a good thing, that many states are studying. They've either established via statute or just have their attorney general studying the Adam Walsh Act. doing cost-benefit analyses. Florida recently just came forward with, and I'd be happy to share with you all, a very pretty good comprehensive report called the Policy and Legal Implications of Implementing the Adam Walsh Act, which is interesting because they did submit a fairly comprehensive bill in 2007, which looked like they were trying to comply, but just this past October, they have come out with this report, which was very telling, and again, you know, with the economic crises going on right now, I think things have changed a little. So anyway, these are the states that we're aware of right now, and I'm sure there are many others, you know, like yourselves that are soon be studying this, but these are the ones that we know of. And just briefly, before I came here, I wanted to check into what's pending in 2009 to see if, you know, states are passing different pieces related to SORNA, and of course they are. About 15 states already in 2009 have pending bills before their different committees and legislatures. Just for example, Arizona is proposing to establish a study committee as well. And Nebraska, New York, and Virginia actually had kind of comprehensive areas, different though than the 2007 laws. They each had about six or seven smaller bills, not one bill that addressed multiple provisions of SORNA. So again, they're all pending, so we don't know what will happen there, but we expect to see many more, and we'll be sure to keep in touch with that. So what are the consequences of non-compliance? And I know I mentioned this earlier that, you know, the loss, this really boils down to money and the loss of 10% in burned funding. Can states afford to comply given the economy and the complexity and the resources that would be needed? And what are the costs? What are some of the costs? When you think about it, some of the costs are, and I've sort of alluded to it along the way, but the software, the technology, you know, states have looked at the huge amount of money that would, resources and time that would go towards linking up with the federal system. Also, the law enforcement costs, court costs, even prison and jail costs for more beds for all these new group of offenders who are going to, you know, whether they, you know, anticipate them not registering or not, and just the increased registration time, the verification. It's all quite a bit more than states have been doing. So the burn funding, 40% of this is sent directly to municipalities or counties from the Department of Justice, and 60% is given to the states to distribute. And these are law enforcement grants for local law enforcement and their activities. A lot goes for gang prevention activities and drug, you know, law enforcement activities, so they're obviously important. And now let's talk specifically about the funding for Burn JAG, because I think this is going to be the piece that states are going to be just watching. Last year, it was cut 67%, and we had seen a trend since 2002 downward. So I think this is, combined with the economy, this gave a lot of states pause into whether or not they, you know, it was even worth it if they were going to have to spend $20 million to implement the Adam Walsh Act or the SORNA of the Adam Walsh Act, and they weren't even only losing 10% of a smaller pot. That's the way you do your cost-benefit analysis. But what's happening is here, Ohio had done such analysis and thought, came up with a total of approximately $19 million. They said it would be $500,000 just to implement the new software in the first year. Virginia's estimated at about $12 million for the first year with all the registry requirements. And Florida, in their recent report, had felt the fiscal impact would be more than $20 million. So those are just a couple numbers, different size states. So the latest is, and I get these numbers from our D.C. staff, that the appropriation for Burn JAG is in the economic stimulus package. And as we speak, and I believe yesterday, I'm not sure if they're through it today, but it's being marked up in the House of Representatives, and there's 31 amendments pending. So we don't know what will happen with it, but as you can see on the slide, there is $3 billion currently for Burn JAG in there. There's actually $4 billion total for local law enforcement. $1 billion of that goes to the COPS, C-O-P-S program, and $3 billion is set aside right now, but we don't know what that means for what will happen along the way for 2009. So again, the House is marking it up this week. It's supposed to get to the full House they think early next week, and then thereafter in the Senate, although our staff in D.C. is not sure of that. So this sort of throws a new kind of curve, because we're seeing this trend maybe reversing now with the new administration, but it's hard to speculate. But this is what we know as of now. So I think that kind of leaves a few approaches or options. Again, is this cost-benefit analysis for the state to kind of see, and also to look really hard at your registration law and see kind of what provisions you already have in place, because for some states there really aren't quite as many as there were for others to mirror the Adam Walsh law. I mean, I haven't heard any state say, oh, we had all of that already, we're fine, but if that's an important part. And then there is this, as we talked about, this opportunity to apply for an extension pending the new Congress action regarding the burn funds, doing the 1 year and then the other 1 year. I don't know how, you know, the smart office does as far as granting these extensions, but I think it's going to be based on that burn funding number and just needing some more time to do your cost-benefit analysis. I want to direct your attention to this handout from my colleagues in D.C. It was just brought to my attention this morning. That's why, forgive me for not including it in the slides. This is some work that was put together by the Justice Policy Institute as well as the National Criminal Justice Association. And I had asked Emily to put together some numbers for Minnesota. So if you've sort of looked here on the first page, I believe this is the numbers of the burn JAG funding in 07, what each municipality, tribal as well, and county received. And then you see in fiscal year 08, when there was the 67% hit, it was, I mean, most of it, I mean, didn't receive $0, basically, a lot of the municipalities. And then if you flip over to the second page, the Justice Policy Institute has, for your state, done an estimate implementation. And again, I have the full report. I don't know how they come to their numbers, but that it would cost about $8 million. And then they're comparing this with the 06 numbers in which you received $3 million. So they're saying that if you choose to not comply and lose 10%, 10% of $3 million would only be this amount. Therefore, your cost-benefit analysis would mean that implementation at this time would not be appropriate, which, again, this is the Justice Policy Institute is strongly biased against the juvenile provisions and against the Adam Walsh Act. So you have to take that into consideration. I mean, these numbers, you know, it's just math, but that is their push. But this is good to have. And again, now I think, again, this wrinkle is that the burn JAG funding has the potential of being much higher, and you certainly don't want to necessarily lose that piece of money. Sounds like just might need some time and use the benefit of this extension opportunity. So, thank you. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Or if there are any specific funding questions, like I said, I can bring them. If I can't answer them, I can try. I can bring them to my colleagues in D.C. and get back to you. Or I'm not sure about the order if you wanted to wait for questions till after the second speaker.
Senator Perso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, Ms. Hammond, would be, what is the initial source of the burn JAG money?
The initial source?
Ms. Hammond.
Oh, yes. The source of the burn JAG funding is, I'm not sure. That's probably something I have to ask Susan. I mean, it's always in the appropriation bill each year, and I have a folder on it. Let me see if I can find that.
Senator Higgins?
While you're looking up.
Yeah, I was going to say, why don't we take another question and I can write that down to answer.
And my question is the grants that are in the supplemental, or in the stimulus bill, are they supplemental to other burn JAG funding that we expect to come in this year, or do we think that that's it for the funding for the year?
Ms. Hammond.
I believe that Susan had told me that would be it, but it's still You know, these are all questions, again, that I kind of just was briefed on this morning, so I'm going to have to check with Susan, especially, too, on the source of the burned bag funding. She was actually supposed to, not supposed to, but we had wanted her to be here, but with the inauguration in D.C. this week, it was just kind of crazy to get around. So, but I'd be happy to deliver any of these questions to her. And again, certainly stay updated with you all, because, like, as of next week, we, you know, could know more and some amendment could have happened. I was checking my email right up to the minute here to see if anything had occurred.
Further questions from members? Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Hammond, for making the time to come. We were very, we didn't know if on such a short notice you would be able to make the time, and I deeply appreciate the partnership the states have with the NCSL. And some of the other work that we've done, I think that states have worked with the NCSL to be the collective voice for states and the various state positions. And I'm wondering if you could share with us a little bit what kind of positions the NCSL has adopted and where the NCSL is with respect to the Adam Walsh Act moving forward. Are there plans or lobbying efforts, perhaps with this new Congress, to amend or to change specific provisions of the Act to make it more palatable or easier economically in the states?
Ms. Hammond.
Thank you. Yes, I'm glad that you asked that, because I did, again, our D.C. office handles all of the lobbying and federalism issues, states' rights, so I thought to check on our Adam Walsh policy, because NCSL does have an official policy, so I have that in front of me here. And I will just kind of give you the highlights. Again, this is something Susan put together. NCSL agrees with the overall purpose of the Act. However, they object to its one-size-fits-all approach to classifying and registering sex offenders. These provisions preempt state laws, create an unfunded mandate for states, because there are no appropriations in the Act or in any appropriations bill. Many of the provisions of the Adam Walsh Act were crafted without state input or consideration for current state practices. The mandates imposed by the Adam Walsh Act are inflexible and in some instances not able to be implemented. So NCSL urges Congress, and this was put in a letter, I believe, last summer, in partnership with the states, to amend the Adam Walsh Act as follows. Delay implementation of the Act for 3 years from the date final registration guidelines have been issued, which was July of last year, 2008. This letter was obviously sent to them before then. Reinstitute the incentive grant provisions of the Act to permit states to submit applications for determination of compliance. Clarify the Adam Walsh Act is applicable only to currently registered sex offenders and not retroactively. Permit states to classify sex offenders according to their current state laws. The federally defined tier classifications are confusing and overly burdensome for states. Permit states to penalize sex offenders according to their current laws. Incorporate flexibility in the implementation of registration. Allow states to define the juvenile offenders meet the criteria for sex offender registration. Provide technological record-keeping requirements. And incorporate language establishing a stakeholder advisory board of state and local national associations like NCSL to provide guidance and counsel to the SMART office, who's responsible for the regulations under the Adam Walsh Act. So we certainly did have some opinions on that. But, yeah, this was written last summer before the federal guidelines came out. I believe it was May or June of 2008 and sent to the Department of Justice.
Senator Moore?
Madam Chair, I'd like to do a follow-up, too. Along those same lines, Ms. Hammond, are you aware of whether or not the other national organizations like the National Governors Association or the National Conference of Mayors, if any of those national organizations have taken a position on the Adam Walsh Act?
Ms. Hammond.
Thank you. I don't know if the NDA has. I know that... yeah, there have been several. None that you mentioned specifically, but that's something I could certainly look into. I can't say that it would be my guess that most of these national organizations, there haven't been a whole lot that have come out in favor of it. I mean, or at least to the point where they think states need more time and need to figure out the economic climate and, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, we get the Adam Walsh Act is virtually, I mean, states were doing things here and there, but sex offenders is one of my issues, and last year, you know, there was a few requests here and there, but it's just since, like, October up to now, it's just incredible because of the time and also because of the economy that states are really, and everybody is saying there's this looming deadline, this new administration, is the smart office still going to be there, you know, what's going to happen. So I think it's going to be like a day-by-day thing, but again, it'd be, you know, we'll be looking closely at it.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Hammond.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to have Harry Kennedy. I'm from the Minnesota State Sex Offender Policy Coordinator. While we wait, members, for the House, in your packet, there is a sign-up sheet if you're interested in taking a tour of some of the Minnesota prisons. So if you please look in your folder, fill those out, and make certain that they get back to the committee administrator, I would appreciate it.
Are going to give me some time on
this? Madam Chair.
Senator Moore.
I think that at some point it would be interesting, maybe when Mr. Kennedy comes up here, he could speak to it a little bit, but I would be interested in hearing from the tribes in Minnesota and their take on the act and how they thought it was going to affect them. And I think that it was an issue of a time or scheduling that we were not able to or couldn't make the effort to put them on the agenda. But at some point, either to myself or perhaps we might talk to the Senate Judiciary Committee members, if there's an interest, I would be interested in hearing what the tribes in Minnesota think, how this is going to affect them.
Thank you, Senator Moore. Mr. Kennedy, I see that you're having some technical difficulties
here.
I believe that we all have a copy of your slide presentation. If you'd like to reset your computer and start with the paper copy, we can have members pull out their paper copies.
Well, thank you for inviting me. My name is Harry Kennedy. I'm the State Sex Offender Policy Coordinator. With me is Bill Dene, with a Risk Assessment and Community Notification Unit from the Department of Corrections. I'd like to talk a little bit first about numbers of sex offenders in Minnesota, just so you get a perspective of what we're dealing with here, and then get into a little bit about what we've been doing with the act. And first of all, the idea of a comprehensive national registration and database and notification system is a worthy goal. As you know, sex offenders are moving around a lot. The states need to communicate well with each other, and the goal supported by the governor of having a national comprehensive system is worthwhile. There are some problems, as I will discuss in a little bit, with certain major issues, retroactivity, juvenile registration, tier levels versus Minnesota's risk assessment system that we will get into. On page 2, there is the total count of offenders in Minnesota's predatory offender registration database. This is operated by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. We currently have actively 14,780 registered sex offenders. There are 3,000 that actually have completed their registration process. That information is still kept in the system, but they are not actively registered offenders. There are just under 1,500 inactive registrants. Those are persons that have moved to another state. The BCA has verified that they are in that other state, and since they're no longer in Minnesota, they don't annually register. If they would come back to the state, the reason they're still in the information section here is because then they would then be required to re-register with the BCA database. Deceased is self-explanatory. Deleted, these are persons whose convictions were vacated, or they came from other states where their conviction did not meet the Minnesota criteria. Those under the info section, 267 offenders. These are persons that are out-of-state transfers, and we're waiting for information on them, and also others that are currently filling out the BCA forms and in the actual registration process. And the 62 offenders under notify are those that have just been notified of their duty to register and are just in the early stages of the registration process. And the computer is still not working here, so we'll keep going. And feel free to ask any questions as I'm presenting here.
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, real quickly, what do you mean when you said, and maybe the previous testifier covered it, but the didn't meet the Minnesota criteria coming from other
states? Well, if there was a registrable, I'm sorry, Representative, Madam Chair, if there was a crime in another state that is not listed in Minnesota statutes under what is required to register for a predatory offender registration, another crime in another state that doesn't meet that criteria, they would not be required to register in Minnesota.
Representative Meyer.
Madam Chair, and then in your opinion, are we easier on the record keeping than they are? In other words, they classify for a sexual offense or a predatory offense in another state and they come here, and we don't think that's serious enough so we don't list them, or?
Mr. Kennedy.
I can't answer that right now. I think Minnesota is very tough with the predatory offender registration system we have currently. I know Superintendent O'Malley is in the audience, and maybe he could provide some further background on that, and we can get back to you on that.
All right. Thank you. Please continue, Mr. Kennedy. Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What you talked about the registration form, do you have a copy of that? And it seems to me that how long would it take to fill out a form, and how complex is it that requires more than the time to see the news?
Mr. Kennedy.
I can provide copies of the form to the committees. That's not a problem. I don't know how long it actually takes with that section with info with the 267 persons. I don't know exactly how long that's taking. That could be a week. That number changes all the time.
Senator Foley, if you could please use your mic. Senator Foley. You don't have to push it. It's on.
Can you hear me now?
Yep.
All right. But I'm curious to know what if you got somebody in prison and they're discharged. There's a lot of things that must be done, I would think, at that time. Registration could or should be part of that.
Well, Senator, by law, Senator, Madam Chair, by law, offenders have to be registered before they leave a correctional facility.
And Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, Ms. Kennedy, how long does it take to register? I mean, it just seems like you're implying that this is a long, costly, or time-consuming deal. Is that correct, or is something relative like going in and filling in the tier one or two or whatever answers there?
Mr. Kennedy.
Madam Chair, Senator.
Mr. Dene.
Bill Dene, Department of Corrections. But one of the things that may be going on is maybe some of these cases may be those who are sentenced to probation and they're not coming to prison, and so the filling of that form, it's a multi-page form, collecting lots of information from that offender. And that form may be completed when he meets with his supervising agent the first time. So there may be a day or two lapse in that in terms from the date of sentencing to the date that he meets with the agent. And in some cases, the offender may not have the competency to fill that form out by him or herself, and they may need the assistance of the supervising agent or some professional. So, you know, that's partial explanation for the time it takes in some cases to get these forms in. Also, it's a matter of just getting the form from the local law enforcement or local corrections office to the BCA and getting it entered.
Further questions from members? All right. Mr. Kennedy, please continue.
Moving on to the next page, Minnesota compliance statistics. This is a significant percentage here because the BCA does a wonderful job in registering predatory offenders, a 94% compliant rate where law enforcement knows where these persons reside. What happens during this process is that the BCA mails an annual letter to the registration address. The offender has 10 days to return that letter, and if that letter is not returned, that offender is then deemed non-compliant and goes on the BCA public website. One concern with SORNA, I'll kind of mix in some concerns the state has with SORNA. SORNA requires all offenders, whether you have a level or not, to be on a public website. In Minnesota, only level 3 offenders are on a public website or those that are non-compliant, and that's about 1,700 persons. If we are to make evidence of this for the charity, if you stay compliant and you're not a level 3 offender, you're not going to go on a public website. And a concern that we have to weigh is if we put all offenders on a public website, will that drastically reduce the 94% compliance rate? And that's a big concern, and we have to study that.
Representative Mullering.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please,
Mr. Kennedy, do we have any idea what that might do to employment of these people or anything like that?
Mr. Kennedy.
Representative, Madam Chair.
Or policy.
I don't think even the public website or well, what SORNA requires. Right now, in Minnesota, some of the information we collect, for instance, address of the offender. It's not the exact address. It's a block where the offender lives. Under SORNA, the exact address would be required, exact address of employment information, and exact address, if in school, of the educational institution. So that could have an effect on employment and housing. Yes. Moving to the next page, the Minnesota risk level statistics. As you are aware, the only time an offender gets a risk level in Minnesota is if that person is coming out of a correctional facility. Just under 3,200 level ones, which is the level one is the lowest risk to possibly reoffend, determined by actuarial tools, the MnSOFs are. Level 2, just about 1,500 level 2s, and that's a medium risk offense, a risk of reoffense determination. And of course, level 3s, which is those most likely to reoffend, the highest likelihood to reoffend. You'll see that 11,000 have no risk levels, and that is because they were sentenced to probation or their conviction was prior to January 97 when the Community Notification and Registration Act was passed by the state, and certain out-of-state offenders. What SORNA would require would be for us to tier all of those offenders, all 15,000. And SORNA is also based, the registration requirement, on convictions. In Minnesota, we do it a little differently. It's based on convictions, but also any charge of conduct arising out of same or similar circumstances. For instance, you have a burglary with intent to commit sexual assault, but you're just convicted of burglary, you're going to have to register. Under SORNA, a worry with a possible adoption of SORNA is that you could have a lot of plea negotiations going on where a person that would be having to register in Minnesota would not register under SORNA because their conviction would not be a sex offense. That's a big concern.
Mm-hmm.
Moving to the next page, predatory offender registration. Currently under 243.166, this continues for as long as registration is required at 10 years or the amount of probation length, whichever is the longest. There's also lifetime registration for repeat offenders, first degree murder, criminal sexual conduct 1 through 4, as well as if you were required to register, if you had lifetime registration in another state, you're going to be required to register for life in Minnesota. There are level 2s and level 3s in the registration process are treated a little differently. If you are a level 3 offender and you're off supervision, you will receive 2 letters instead of 1 from the BCA. Also, if you're a level 2 or 3 and you are off supervision, you're going to have an annual in-person contact with law enforcement. Right now...
Excuse me, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kennedy, what is the situation if a person doesn't register that comes into the system?
Well, Mr. first of all, they would, Representative, Madam Chair, they would be found noncompliant, and there's a felony penalty of not more than 5 years. So it would be a felony sanction, as well as 5 years. The clock would restart on the registration process, and an additional 5 years would be added on to that registration period.
Thank you.
So it's a tough sanction.
Mr. Kennedy, it looks like we're not going to be able to get your computer working, but we can do an overhead, so we can put your slides up on the TV via overhead, if that would be all right.
Okay, sure.
You just need to move your computer so the piece of paper can go there.
I see what you're saying now. There we go.
Is that helpful? Go ahead, Mr. Kennedy.
The last point there on predatory offender registration, levels 2 and 3, when you're off supervision, we do have Minnesota's system is based registration verification process on the mail. FORNA is based on in-person verification. We're debating right now what's actually our process. Some people think, well, you have those in-person verifications, that's got to be better than just getting a letter. Well, a person could live in another state, drive in and have their in-person verification and then leave. The letter, at least we know that letter's been sent to an address, and that letter comes back from that same address. Could there be circumstances where someone that's not the offender is sending that letter? Possibly, but I think by and large it's probably accurate. And so continuing that mail verification is an important thing. Also, with FORNA, our in-person verifications in the state would increase would increase by 39,000. And local law enforcement, I've been working with the Sheriff's Association and the Police Chiefs Association to try and figure out what those costs would be for all of those added in-person verifications. And it would probably be millions of dollars. The BCA, and it's interesting, we have been partnering well with the Smart Office. The BCA was awarded a grant by the Smart Office, one of the few states to receive such a grant. Because there are some technological innovations with the in-person verification, with fingerprint identification, and being able to not only do the mail, but do a quicker version of in-person verification where we may be able to reduce the cost of having in-person visits by local law enforcement.
Madam Chair?
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, can you tell me when you're looking at getting the data and so forth, do you have access to biometric determinations of who the person is in every case?
Mr. Kennedy.
In every case? I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What you're gathering information, as I can see from what has now indicated, control and identification of one, and publication in some cases, and it seems like that first of all, you aren't going to be able to use the data if there isn't a biometric identifier, but if there is, you still got Minnesota statutes that deal with data privacy. How does that comport with what you're doing?
Mr. Kennedy, and your notes are filling up on
the head. That's okay. It's just a response. Really messy writing too. We've got the biometric information, and quite frankly, right now with what the DCA is working on with the new technology, I don't quite understand myself right now. But I know there's an enhancement that will use biometrics and other information to be gathered as part of this grant proposal. If that answers your question.
Senator Foley.
I'm sure that takes me so far. But when you get to the point where you don't have the biometric identifiers, well, I don't see how that would fit in with any database that we have, and that at some point or another, you should have done the identification before the party was discharged or whatever you do with Go ahead.
Well, Senator, Madam Chair, I can look into your concerns and we can get an answer back to you on that.
Okay.
Please continue, Mr. Kennedy.
Briefly on community notification, risk levels are assigned by DOC to adult release of prison after January 1, 1997. They're based on the MnSOS-R, which is an actuarial tool. Also developed in Minnesota, Bill. You want to comment more on the tool and how it works for everybody?
Well, the MnSOS-R, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. The MnSOS-R, as Harry said, is an actuarial instrument, and by actuarial we mean the type of instrument that the insurance industry uses in estimating the probability of an event occurring. So it's what it does is it identifies the characteristics that a person has, and then takes a look in the past, people who had those characteristics, how many of them reoffended. So it's based upon considerable research, empirical research, taking a look at reoffending offenders over several years. And so this is how we arrive at an estimation of the risk that this person presents in the community. And this is in contrast to the SORNA, which bases the tiers based upon the conviction of record, which is a very different approach. At this point, there is no research that demonstrates that the conviction of record is related to the risk or the likelihood of reoffending. Just to get a little more specific, is the actuarial, the MnSOS-R is one actuarial. There's a couple of others used across the country as well. The MnSOS-R is used in several other states as well. Those instruments take a look at the behavior of the individual offender, the behavior in the offense, as well as the prior behavior, as well as some demographic information and other aspects of that offender's general personality and that sort of thing. When you take a look at the conviction history, you have to remember that 90 to 95% of our convictions are based upon plea negotiation. So there's very little, many cases, there's very little relationship between the conviction and the behavior of the offense. And so there's considerable questions in the field as whether or not basing a tier level based upon the conviction has any relationship to the risk that that particular person presents to the public. There's some that suggest that, for instance, Dr. Jill Levinson, who's done considerable research out of Florida, suggest that if we go at it that way, we're going to end up with many high-risk offenders categorized as the low-risk and several low-risk offenders identified as high-risk. And that's another concern between the two different systems. And that's sort of what Harry's trying to is addressed here in terms of the risk assessment system based upon actuarials. It's got some research behind it, and it correlates between with risk levels and likelihood of reoffending. As there is no data suggesting that tier levels based upon conviction has that same sort of correlation.
Mr. Kennedy?
The last section there, community notification, is the notification provided to the different levels. You know, if you're a level one offender, law enforcement knows about your release from the community, and victims or witnesses are notified, but it's the first tier of notification. If you're a level two offender, the notification is determined by the victim pool. Obviously, child molesters, you're going to be notifying the daycares and the schools and things like that. And it all depends on your characteristics of your sex offenses. But law enforcement, again, knows exactly where that offender is. And it's a bit more of a stepped-up notification process. Finally, level three, you're put on the DOC public website, and there's a community notification meeting, which I'm sure many of you have attended in districts before. I've attended a lot of them. And the question I get a lot is, why are we just putting level three offenders on a public website? Why can't you tell us about the level twos, especially, or all offenders? And that's something we need to weigh. The policy, the laws that have been passed in Minnesota right now is just level three offenders and those that are non-compliant. But there is, and you've probably heard it in the meetings you've attended, people wanting more notification. That's one of the aspects of SORNA that is encouraging. There's a lot that we have to work out with this act, but it definitely does increase community notification of sex offenders coming to your neighborhood.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Kennedy, I remember in talking to some of the authors of this original, it was before I got here, but they said there was an extreme concern about who we had community notification for, because the Supreme Court had apparently some issues with how far down we went on the levels about notifying them. Wouldn't that cause a lot of concern if SORNA is requiring everybody to do it, or to put everybody on?
Mr. Kennedy.
I'm digesting your question there. You were concerned the Supreme Court had rendered a decision that increased notification was going to cause problems. I guess I didn't follow your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I remember being told by some of the people that worked on the original legislation, which was, like I say, before I was here, that because I asked them how we distinguished who we would put up there, and they said because they were worried about something about the Supreme Court and how far we could go about putting records of people up. And it would seem that if we couldn't go to everybody, or there was concern about that, wouldn't SORNA draw that issue into concern then?
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative, Madam Chair, many states have everybody on a public website. Some states in relation to SORNA are going to make everybody be lifetime registered. They don't want to deal with all the tiers. Everybody's going to be a tier three. Ohio was referenced in the presentation. I think one thing we've done well in Minnesota is that we've been pretty measured in looking at SORNA, trying to figure out what the problems are, what we're doing right in Minnesota that we don't want to jeopardize. Ohio decided to be the first state to, I don't want to bash too much in Ohio, but they wanted to be the first state to implement SORNA. And they passed legislation before even the proposed guidelines came out. Tremendous amount of litigation going on in Ohio right now in terms of retroactivity, their registration process, and that's something that we want to avoid. We're following these cases, Ohio, Nevada, Alaska, some of those states, there's some very interesting cases that are going on. We're following and monitoring those cases because we want to avoid those pitfalls.
Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So where do we stop? I mean, do we start putting everybody who was arrested but not found guilty? You know, somebody who's got a rumor in the neighborhood that, you know, Joe Blow over there, he does bad things but has never been arrested. I mean, where do we stop putting people up on a public website when, you know, as Representative Mullery said, they can't find a house to live in, they can't find a job? When are we going to stop all this nonsense? And, you know, we've got the tiers of people who are categorized by their likelihood to reoffend, right? Level 3s are the most likely to reoffend. Maybe we should do a little research on the recidivism rate on the 1s and 2s and, you know, make a determination about whether the risk is actually there. You know, we have communities where people really struggle for finding a decent job, and then when we put this kind of stuff on top of all of those things that they have to put up with when they're reentering the community after serving their time, it's just getting to be really difficult for people to start over again. And this legislature in the last couple of years has made good steps toward helping people reenter society. And I think that, you know, all of this stuff about putting everybody and his uncle up on a public website is not serving us all the best it can be. Representative Lesch.
Thank you. And thank you, Madam Chair. And just to address a little bit Senator Higgins' comments, I feel you on that. I understand, and I hear about a lot of people who have these concerns about reentry and collateral consequences. That said, not a lot of people around this table are prosecutors or have been prosecutors, and it's difficult to convict someone. Now, these are people who have been duly convicted by a jury of their peers using constitutional due process, or that's the way it's supposed to work. And so, for me, that's the line. Now, when you go past that, whether people are arrested or what have you, I completely understand. But when actually you get people convicted by a jury of their peers that requires that jury to be unanimous on the facts, I think that these are people that absolutely should have, as the pejorative term is used, a scarlet letter, because we have a right to know who they are. There's no question. There's a difference between civil law and criminal law. And if you get convicted of a criminal law, you're a danger to society, and society has a right to know. In small towns in Minnesota, everyone knows who those people are. You know who they are. I mean, on my street, on the streets of many people around this table, we have no idea. I don't know if I'm working next to this person. I don't know if I'm living next to this person. And all I have is the public record. So that's why I think it's important. But to address the question, I think the important thing should be the conviction.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Kennedy, perhaps you could clarify for us. I understand that SARNA requests looks at individuals who are eligible for registration based on conviction. But Minnesota law is a little bit broader than that. Is that correct, that we consider people eligible for registration based on the charge? And it's the tiering process where they maintain it based on conviction, but we go to the risk assessment. Is that correct?
Correct.
Mr. Kennedy. Thank you.
Senator Stein. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is not an area of the law with which I'm familiar at all, but I've heard a couple of things recently, and I just wanted to ask you, apparently level one is the lowest level of offense, the least serious, or less serious. I don't mean to imply that any of these are not serious, but in the whole scheme of things, can you tell me, is a, say, an 18-year-old, a 19-year-old boy, young man who has consensual sexual relations with a girlfriend who's 15 or 16, do they get on this list?
Mr. Kennedy.
Senator, Madam Chair, you mean the SORNA, the tiers, or?
Actually, with what we have and with SORNA. Either, both, I'd say.
SORNA does have an age difference provision in the Act, where if you are, if the victim, if you will, is over 13 years of age and the offender is not greater than 4 years older, the age difference crimes, you're not going to be registering with a SORNA tier. We have the same kind of, and I don't know, there's about three different categories in Minnesota, but we have the same kind of age difference exceptions in Minnesota, but I couldn't give you the exact age range. Maybe Bill, you know that? But I can find that information out for you if you like.
Mr. Dene.
Madam Chair, Senator, the age differences that I don't want to, I don't think I can give you right now, but in terms of the public website, the case you mentioned would, in all likelihood, in many cases, that case would be a probation. He would not get a risk level, but if he were to violate his probation and come to prison without knowing more about the case, but just as you explained it, that would probably be a risk level one, and that person would not go on a website. In Minnesota, correct.
Senator Sutton.
Then, Madam Chair, and I heard something on a reputable radio station and program the other day that concerned me, and that had to do with, I think it was called sex texting, and it has to do with teenagers, some of whom are young or even preteens, sending nude photos or photos, doing something which could be deemed pornographic and in fact could be charged with dissemination of pornography and ending up as sex offenders. Is that true? Because that alarms me if that's true, that somebody would for the rest of their days be known as a sex offender having done something horribly foolish, but maybe not.
Mr. Kennedy.
Senator, Madam Chair, under SORNA, that person would probably be a Tier 2 offender. It depends. The recipient might be a Tier 2 offender because that person actually created what would be deemed pornography. They might be a Tier 3 offender. Because under SORNA, for possession, you are at least a level 2. If you are creating or distributing, you are a tier level 3.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kay, could you tell me a little bit about who the perpetrators and victims are? My understanding is that it often isn't so much anonymous or stranger, but to a large extent, relatives and families that are involved in sex offenses. Do you have any percentages or numbers on that? I'm just curious how that would play out on a...
Well, I know Mr. Janae is, this is part of his regular presentation at community notification meeting, so I know he's chomping at the bit to get this out, so I'll let Bill answer.
Mr. Janae.
Madam Chair, member, to answer to your question, depending upon what studies that we're looking at and how you define the players, generally between 85% to 90% of the sex offenses, the offender is known by the victim, either a family member, an acquaintance, or a professional in their life. A couple other things that I think it's important to think about when you're talking about public policy and this issue is, I call it the three 90s and the two R's, is 90% of the sex offenders in Minnesota do not reoffend within the 10 years after release. 90% of them are known by their victim. And another piece that came to me a couple of years ago, which sort of just shocked me because it's all, I've been in this business many years. And I've always said if we could just reduce recidivism, if we could wipe out recidivism, that would really solve sexual violence in Minnesota. What came to my attention was that 90% of the sex offenders admitted to prison have no prior sex offense. And that's pretty astounding when you think of all of the, sex offense conviction, right? When we think of the websites, the registration, and all of the effort we focus on convicted sex offenders, we're really focusing on 10% of the problem, and 90% of those do not reoffend. And I don't mean to minimize the seriousness of sexual reoffense. I see files every day that points out to me the serious issue we're dealing with. When we start talking about allocating major resources and we start talking about preventing sexual violence in Minnesota, I think it's important to remember those 390s. In terms of the public website, putting on everyone on the website, nationally there have been some studies of the effectiveness of community notification. It's somewhat unclear right now. A couple studies indicate that maybe it does reduce recidivism. Other studies sort of lean the other way. I think it's important to remember from my unit, we operate the Level 3 website, and today we have about 143 Level 3s in the community on a website. As you notice, about 850 Level 3s, the remaining ones are either back in prison as release violators, some type of new offense, generally not a sex offense, or they've been committed to the DHS, to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, as a sexually dangerous person. But what I wanted to point out was we calculate it takes three-fourths to one, up to one full-time equivalent employee to maintain the accuracy of that Level 3 website, about 140 offenders. When you start talking about putting, 15,000 offenders on a website, it begins to concern me because, in my opinion, a website, if you're going to do this, it has to be accurate and it has to be on time. If you have an inaccurate website, you may be causing more harm than good. If you have a website that indicates that this sex offender lives in neighborhood A, he doesn't live there, but neighborhood A is watching that house, but sex offender lives in neighborhood B, and that neighborhood is not on the website, and that neighborhood is assuming he does not live in their neighborhood. So it points to me that if you have information on a website regarding these sex offenders, it needs to be accurate. And in order to be accurate, it takes resources.
All right, members, the time for the committee is starting to run to a close, and we want Mr. Kennedy to be able to finish his presentation. So if you could
get through. The next page is just what Minnesota has been doing over the years for sex offender registration. Great legislation passed in this state, so a credit to you all. You can read that. It's self-explanatory. But we're doing we do a lot of good things in Minnesota, especially with the Predatory Offender Registration Database and the community notification meetings and the DOC Level 3 public website. So we're moving in the right direction. We want to make sure we need time to study SORNA more thoroughly to make sure that we don't jeopardize the good things we're already doing in Minnesota. The next page regarding SORNA compliance. We are already compliant in many areas with SORNA. We register attempts and conspiracies and aiding and abetting registration for comparable federal and military offenses. We have a state-of-the-art BCA, Predatory Offender Registration Database. The majority in the presentation by NCSL, the majority of the information stated that SORNA requires states to collect, we collect that. It's not all made public, but we have that information in the BCA proprietary database. We're a partner in the Drew Shadeen National Sex Offender Public Website. And I'd just like to mention at this point, Linda Walker, Drew Shadeen's mother, is here today, and I appreciate her constant advocacy and desire to assist me.